Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's October 11, 2015, and welcome to episode 111 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
YRCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, making things, breaking things, and fixing things. Hi, I'm Michael Mulhern. I'm your host for episode 111. With me today is Paul Hagstrom. Paul, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. It was really tempting to just say it was November, just so that it would have been 11-11 on episode 111. But
We'll have to do something about that year, 2015, just really put a spanner in there. But good to hear that things are okay. And special guest, Charles Mangan. How are you today, Charles?
I'm doing just fine. I'm glad to be here on show number 7.
Yes.
Excellent. I'm glad to see someone can count. Well, we were nutting our heads together to see if we could come up with a host topic. And I was thinking, with Charles here, 3D printing 101. Where do you start? What are the pitfalls? What are some of the limits of what you can do apart from your imagination? And also, how can we use 3D printing to work with our retro computers? So, Charles, with 3D printing, where do you start?
Usually when I'm trying to tackle some new topic, whether it's retro-related or some new tool or new technique, software even, I try to find something that I don't yet know how to do, but I want to get it done. So with 3D printing, the first thing that I did was modeled something that I had on hand, which happened to be a Disk II floppy drive. And with that, I learned how to make boxes, very simple things in at the time, I think I was using SketchUp and a couple of other sort of free or open source 3D modeling programs just to see what I could do just, with me and my laptop and the free stuff that was out there on the internet as far as tutorials go. After a few more rounds of, well, this is neat, I can make a model of this and rotate it in 3D space, I settled on using 123D Design from Autodesk, which is free, Mac and PC, and I believe you can even do it in a web browser if you're patient. And wanted to make that model of the Disk II into something that I could then get printed out somewhere and maybe stuff a USB drive in it. And then I realized, hey, it's a floppy drive. Why don't I make it the right size so I can put an SD card in it or a compact flash card in it and make that the floppy disk that goes in the drive. And so that kind of got the ball rolling for me was, I have a project. I don't know how to do it, so I'm going to learn the steps. And that's what I would probably suggest for a lot of people for learning new things, whether it's 3D printing or relearning assembly programming or anything, is find that thing that you need to make and learn the steps to make it.
Well, it sounds like starting simple and then building up from there. So you started with basically drawing boxes, making the regular shapes. And then when you realize that, hey, I could turn this into an SD drive, I figure that the next thing to do was, how do I add in mounting points? How do I keep the structure solid so that it's not going to collapse when someone pushes down on it to hold it steady while they put the card in? And then also I gather that you've got to make sure that any parts that you put together are the right tolerances. So are there any sort of like difficulties in making like multi-parts for your 3D creations?
Yeah, there's, and actually just from hearing you say that, you're about 8 or 10 steps ahead of where I was when I first started thinking about tolerances and support structure. I didn't know what the tolerance was for the printers. I knew I was going to get something done probably at Shapeways just because it was easiest and I didn't have my own 3D printer. I could send them the file and they would send me a part. And that's still who I use for getting things printed out, by the way. So if you're interested, you want to browse what they have as far as materials and how they how their process works. They have some really great videos online and some really great, not necessarily beginner information, but good stuff about the process that they use, which is going to be different from your desktop 3D printer, if we're going to get into that topic a little bit further on. But yes, the idea of the material, what can it do? How strong is it? Can I make something that's really thin and it still be able to stand up to someone, you know, plugging it into a computer or sitting on it or, you know, throwing it in their backpack or what have you. And so that was a long and I'd say mildly expensive learning process because each of these prototypes is not necessarily free. And I went through several rounds and eventually got to the point where I was making things for myself that I was happy with and then putting them online to see if other people wanted to buy them. And now I've got a considerable, well, it's not paying the rent by any means, but I've got a business going and it keeps me busy.
Yeah, I think it's really excellent that something like Shapeways exists. I mean, like it isn't something that I am myself likely to do, to sort of like go out and buy a 3D printer, because first of all, I didn't even know how to shop for one. and you know, it does sort of seem like whatever I get, it's going to become obsolete, and Shapeways is the business that's in, you know, that's doing this, and so they're going to stay up to date. And so it really does, you know, I actually have never looked into the cost structure, but I mean, it does sort of seem like it reduces the barrier quite a bit to entry if all I have to do is just do some CAD work.
Right. It does. And there's, you're right about not knowing how to shop for a 3D printer, because right now, and I've said it before and other people have made this comparison, it's sort of the early 80s PC revolution all over again, but this time with machines that squirt out plastic. And in a few months, there's going to be another one that's half the price and twice the quality of the one that you have on your desk that you bought today, or the one that you put together that you love and you've put all this work and effort into upgrading. Another one's going to come out with a shiny corporate logo on it that's plug and play, and you you know, you drop plastic in one end and out comes a widget at the other. And the comparison to personal computing is a really good one, because you don't know which of those brands are still going to be around in 6 months or a year, which ones are going to buy each other out, which ones are not going to be compatible with the software or hardware that you might buy now in a store. 'Cause you can actually go and get some of the MakerBot, I think, has stuff in like Home Depot or Lowe's. Some of the hardware stores are carrying things like filament, and it's a weird thing to see that. And then at the same time, I mentioned 3D printing to people, and they have no idea what I'm talking about. It's like, oh, it's in Lowe's now. It's in your local hardware store, so it's at that level of awareness. But at the same time, it's not something like a screwdriver that everybody knows instinctively. Okay, I go to the store, I get a screwdriver, I can use it and screw things in and build stuff with it. It's much more complicated than that, even to just explain.
Yeah, so it seems like there are sort of two retro computing kind of branches of application that you've worked with too on this. That so you know, one is actually, we've got the actual retro computer here and I'm missing three keys, you know, or a post or something on
right
and
yeah, or a hinge on the front of the bezel on a monitor, or the door on the floppy drive. And yeah,
right,
so those parts, nobody's making them anymore and the molds have long since disappeared. And if you wanted to buy one, you'd have to go on eBay and scout for a month to find one, or buy a whole new machine just for parts if you wanted that one part.
And that's so hard to do.
And so, yeah, that's the that's one of the things that I've started doing more and more of, is recreating those pieces in 3D, so that right now I'm getting them produced at Shapeways, you know, one at a time, and maybe 5 and 10 at a time when it comes to things like keycaps, where they're small enough for the posts where people need, you know, enough for a whole row on an Apple II. And that's great for that small number, but if it gets to the point where the supply is totally dried up, and, you know, or people are charging outrageous rates for ones that are in good shape or even ones that are in bad shape, and I wanted to go somewhere, or somebody wanted to take those files that I put out on the internet, and they're all Creative Commons, take those files to someone that does injection molding, that does small batch prototyping, and do a run of 500 Apple IIe keycaps and do them in custom colors, or you know, do a recreation like the Commodore 64, the 64 or the 128, where they got rights to the molds and have been making new cases. I think you guys have talked about that in a previous episode. I think
it was the 64C.
Yeah, the 64. Yeah, they did the colored cases and the clear case. They had the original molds, and then there's other projects where they're actually.
So yeah, they bought the IP and they bought the molds, and were able to get new castings made, and that's great for a community that is, you know, as small but as enthusiastic as ours. It'd be great to be able to do that. It's not something where you would, you know, get a master mold made and make 10,000 of them a day in some factory in Shenzhen, but it's enough interest, at least in some of these things, to make a few hundred for people that are enthusiastic about it. And so that would be the next step up, obviously, from doing them 3D printed one at a time. But the background work of getting there is making a 3D model or making a mold. And that's part of what I'm doing right now with things like the, you know, keycaps and hinges. And I just recently did, there's a leg that's this strange curved leg on the back of some Apple design speakers. And when they ship, or a lot of times when they're stored in a box or something, they're brittle and they break. So I modeled those, and now those are up on Shapeways and Thingiverse for people if they want to print their own.
Well, that's got me thinking. You're making replacement parts, and how do you go about making sure that the posts or the keycaps are actually up to being fit for purpose, you might say?
Yeah, like, are they strong enough? And that sort of,
are they strong enough, or is it really just to fill in the blank?
To some extent, it's plastic, and it's flexible enough and strong enough for real-world use and, you know, real-world abuse and prototyping, so that it has to be strong enough for that. But there are several different materials you can make things out of with varying degrees of downside, I suppose, between the expense and the speed at which you can make it, or the detail that it comes out. You can make things in ABS plastic, which is the same plastic they make Legos out of, and that stuff's fairly indestructible. And as long as you are doing the printing in the right way and the right orientation, it's strong enough to be used in a, you know, in a real world part, like a toy for your kids, and it's, you know, it's not going to break any more readily than the toy that they broke in the first place that you're replacing. And the materials that you can get from Shapeways, for instance, their basic material is called quote unquote strong and flexible, and it comes in a variety of colors. And it's good enough for most stuff. The key posts might be a little bit weak and brittle compared to a brand new keyboard, but I think they're comparable to the ones that are 30 years old and have been yellowing and getting brittle with age. The nice thing that you can do, though, is if there's a failure point, you can design around it, because you have 30 years worth of data and a bunch of keyboards. Okay, they've all failed at this point. I'll have to make that stronger.
So you're not having to make it physically identical in some cases, as long as it still operates within the space that's available. You can strengthen it up in certain places and still use it.
Right, and there are physical constraints too that you don't have to worry about with getting things 3D printed. Obviously, if you went to a mold process, there would be overhangs and tolerances that are different. But if you're replacing something with a one-off 3D printed part, then you can design it to be functionally identical, and yet whatever design makes sense to you or makes sense to the part. If there's a place where, like I said, it's weak, or the design is shown to be, you know, not ergonomically whatever, then you can design around that, and then you have a, you know, a custom part that you don't have to worry about it matching up necessarily. And I'm rambling. I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Welcome to RCR.
Talking about the different materials, I suppose that's the advantage of getting something done through Shapeways, is that you can get multiple pieces, each done in a different type of material, as opposed to having your own 3D printer, which I suppose a 3D printer is limited to the one type of material feed. Would that be correct?
Correct. For the vast majority of printers that are out there, especially the consumer level ones that are coming out in the world now, they're limited to things that come on a filament. So it has to be something that melts between a certain temperature and under a certain temperature, and can be made into a flexible enough filament to go into the nozzle of the extruder. And there's a limited number of variables you can mess with that. So you can get things like PLA, which is a different temperature that melts a different temperature from ABS, and another sort of family of these composites where when it prints out, it has a different texture or different qualities to it. But in essence, you're limited with those kinds of printers to things that melt and that they can make a filament out of. And there are other printers that are very specific to making a model out of a resin that's cured with UV. And it's not like you can change the qualities of that resin on the fly and make a stronger part or a heavier part or one that's translucent versus not. It's the resin that you get is chemically specific to that UV light that is in the printer. So doing things with a vendor like Shapeways, and I keep saying Shapeways because that's the one that I use, but there are several others out there if you do the research, and some of them are in Europe. If you're in Europe and you are trying to get something from the US, the shipping time or the cost might be a little outrageous. So there's ones that are based in, you know, France and the UK and the EU. They have a variety of different printers, and they each one uses a different material, and they can even do batches of a certain type in a certain printer. And once they get, you know, enough experience, they can offer that for sale on their site as a new material. So they're doing things that are flexible. They're doing things in metal. They're doing things for wax casting. Obviously they're doing the plastics that I use. They have all of the materials and all the experience to offer a wide range of things that you'd never be able to get to at a consumer level on your desk.
Yeah. I was thinking, I know that a couple of the things that I am tempted to want in a 3D printed version are things like eject gears on the, you know, the disk drives, or there's a similar kind of gear that always breaks on the ImageWriter 2 sheet feeder. And, you know, so these are the kinds of things that where I worry a little bit. Like I wonder if 3D printing is up to it. I seem to recall there was some kind of discussion on the Apple II enthusiasts Facebook group possibly about you know, redoing these little gears, and I don't remember what the conclusion was, but I know that that's, you know, there's certainly a need for that, and maybe some of these parts actually do, you know, maybe they're standard enough that they could be ordered if you can figure out what, you know, what they actually are, but like even now,
yeah, with gears there's probably a way to say, oh, it's this diameter interior, this diameter, and this number of teeth, and you can order it in a variety of materials from like McMaster Car or something. But you know, again, with 30 and 35 year old plastic and nylon getting brittle and you know, shattering over time, you can replace that part with one that's 3D printed in metal. You know, it starts out as a powdered steel, and then it gets laser sintered together, and it's, you know, it comes out as a piece of solid steel, and that gear's hopefully never going to break.
The future is amazing.
The expense on that for one tiny little gear is a bit much. It's certainly going to be more than ordering one from, you know, McMaster Car and waiting for shipping. But the idea of having something in a material that didn't exist, or making something that's going to last for 100 years versus that, you know, something that broke after one, is intriguing, considering, you know, NASA is making rocket engines out of the stuff. They're, you know, they have giant printers that are working in titanium powder, and, you know, coming up with designs for nozzles and jet engines and, you know, fuel intake systems that they could never put together with welding. And that sort of stuff is filtering down into the, you know, the vendor level and the consumer level for making prototypes and for making, making products, not necessarily mass produced, but at the level of our hobby, where, you know, mass produced is 100 Ethernet cards or you know, a few hundred CFFAs in a run that saturates the market. You know, the level of manufacture, the number that you can make at a time is probably okay.
But when you're looking to repair things or even make new, you're using the NASA titanium 3D printing as an example. You're talking about a batch of one, so it doesn't really become that unrealistic to be spending a lot of money to get that part made because of, you know, the inability to use whatever it is without that part. I know my brother has a fabrication business that he has laser cutters, and he will make replacement parts for machinery that will do the job for a couple of months while they're waiting for the actual proper part that they need to put on there. You know, even just, you know, something simple as cutting teeth on a digger. You know, he can have a machine back operational quickly while the replacement cut part takes, you know, weeks to arrive. So I can see that repairing some of our older retro equipment, it wouldn't be unrealistic to spend tens or in some cases hundreds of dollars to get it operational again, because without those parts that you're going to print off in a batch of one or a batch of two, you're not going to be using something. And I know for the retro computer hobbyist, some of that cost is personal and time, but you know, I've got a few machines where I probably would not be against spending some serious coin to have replacement parts done. It's just that I've never had the wherewithal to look at getting my own 3D printer to get that done, and I quite like the idea of getting a third-party vendor to make the part and ship it to me. And maybe I can concentrate on the design stage and then take it from there.
Right. There's also a lot of places in larger towns and cities now that have maker spaces, and they'll have your your laser cutter or somewhere where you can get a bandsaw and do woodworking. But a lot of times they're also going to have a 3D printer. It's going to be the consumer level stuff generally, where you're doing, printing things out in ABS or PLA plastic, and it's not as high resolution as something you might get from Shapeways or from one of the online vendors that have the industrial size printers. But if you're replacing, the drive door in something, or the knob on the front of a classic radio, for instance, or the hook that hangs the thing that does the thing that you can't do without, and you just need it, and it takes an hour to print out, as opposed to trying to find it in the catalog or go online and find somebody that has one to replace yours. That kind of stuff, if you can get into a maker space and find someone to help you that knows how to do the modeling and knows how to run the printer, or if you can learn yourself online and then send them a file, that kind of stuff is great too. You're not limited to just the expensive stuff that you have to do through the interwebs. You can actually go to a lot of places and see hands on how these things are done. And there's all the makerspaces I've walked into have somebody that will be glad to help take time off of their own project to show you how to do something new. And that's part of the great thing about the community of makers in general. But if you have a cool project, it doesn't matter what community you're in, there's people that want to help you because it's a cool project.
Cool.
Well, definitely sounds like the way to go, because I'm just thinking now I've got at least half a dozen different machines that are missing back plates or a access panel or a little flip-down door for putting the cables through. And maybe that's the sort of thing that people could be getting a little bit of experience designing up that part, or even I suppose it'd be too difficult to us to say that you could find some kind of existing schematic or diagram, seeing that the machines are that old. But just to start making a replacement, simple pieces like that, which just to complete it, and most of our stuff is spray painted plastic as it is.
True.
Which is a whole new story on color matching and getting the spray silver chrome paint to have that same sheen and gloss as the original spray painted plastic.
That's a whole different discussion. Those are those are topics for a model maker or the prop making communities online. They get very intricate with the details and color matching and matching the finish of something that, Han Solo had in his pocket in this scene in Empire Strikes Back, and we have to make sure that we can find just that specific Greebly that has just that specific. Yeah, so those guys are the ones to talk to about finishes and colors. But if you want to contact me online and send me a broken part, or send me something that you have one of and you want five of, and you want me to make the model for it, I can do that and send it back to you in the post with a with a 3D printed version along with it for the ride.
Cool. Yeah, and so, it's probably we should turn away from the host topic before too long, but I did want to mention that the other of the two things that are retro computing related.
Oh, right. You said there were two things.
but you've been exploring this, and actually it's quite possible that people are even more familiar with you from this, is you've been making retro computer shaped, generally a Raspberry Pi cases, so modern but tiny computers inside, like a little Apple IIe shaped thing, or recently you've been teasing us with the Lisa shaped things and Apple III shaped things that we're looking forward to seeing. Actually, I assume that's sort of a similar project, at least, you're trying to get all the dimensions and stuff right, except now you're, multiplying by whatever it is, 0.3. But,
right. Yeah. It started with the first couple of things that I did was modeling stuff that I had around me so that I would have something to create in miniature. And then realizing that having a little block of plastic on my desk that's a miniature version of this computer that I love isn't really all that great, as much as the computer itself, which is something that's functional, make it functional. So there's a Raspberry Pi sitting next to me that has nothing to do and it needs a case. And so I put the one with the other. The idea of making these miniatures for people that are, they're retro computer fans and also Raspberry Pi fans, making a niche within a niche. Mm-hmm. It's something that people probably have looked at and kind of shook their head and wondered why, and sometimes I do as well. But the idea is that I take a real world thing and I model it in as much detail as I can. If I have calipers and the rulers, and I have a protractor to measure angles, and I take some liberties with it because I know that it's going to be shrunk down to 1/4 scale. So if something has a little bit of a gap around it, I might actually make the gap bigger in the model because I know that that gap is going to disappear. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, a half of a millimeter wide when it's printed. So I might make it a little bit bigger when I shrink the model down. But I try to be as accurate as possible so that when I come back to it later on and take the finished model and put it on the internet for somebody, they could make it at any scale. So if they wanted a drive door for the 2C, they could take that model of my 2C and scale it to actual size and get a drive door, the drive door hinge, at least get the proper dimensions of it, or be able to take that model and put it in something that they're building and say, okay, this is the size of the desk that I need, or I'm going to build a monitor, or I'm going to have an LCD inside of this case, but I don't have the actual case yet, so I can take that monitor and figure out the dimensions, that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to be as accurate as I can. But with things like the Lisa and the Apple III, I don't have those. I don't have them in my in my collection. So I've had to work as best I can from photographs and from the patent drawings, from various design documents that are online, things like the repair manuals, especially for the Apple III, because I don't have as much experience with one. But taking it apart, and what are all the parts and pieces that come out of it as you're taking it apart, the repair manuals and catalogs for replacement parts for Apple dealers have come in very handy. You say, okay, this is the keyboard part, and this has the dimensions drawn on it, and it has these angles, and I can see from the drawing, because it's a mechanical drawing, how they fit together. So yeah, the ones that I've worked on most recently, the Lisa and Lisa 2/Mac XL are online and available right now. The Apple III that you mentioned, I'm taking my time with that one, and I'm sorry I'm teasing it so much for the Apple III lovers, but what I'm doing with that one specifically is from start to finish, I'm documenting the whole thing. So I did screen capture of the process of researching the photos and the drawings and everything, and getting that into the 3D model. And then now, as I'm painting it and sanding and finishing and all that, I'm taking video as I'm doing it. So I'll have a documented from blank slate all the way to the finished piece, so that people can see the process, see what I go into with modeling it and making it into a physical thing, and then all the work that goes into painting and sanding and polishing and all the rest. Because people have always asked, what's the process? How hard is it? Why is it so expensive? What are you using for this? What are you doing for that? And so I'm trying to make it as detailed as I can for this one. So when I'm done, I'll put that online and people can see kind of it might be the fast forward view. Or the time lapse view, they'll be able to see all the steps that go into it.
You don't have 2 weeks to watch the video.
No, it's not going to. Oh yeah, nobody's going to sit there and watch that.
Oh, that's definitely something that we would link to for our listeners, and maybe would inspire others to look at inserting Retro Computer here and what's involved and to what level they could take it, because it'd be great to sort of see it, as you said, from the complete design stage through to the printing and the finishing for the product, and I myself would love to see that process. And as you said, it's all together in a single blog with a series of videos. It's a lot easier than organizing to pop over and see what you're doing on the weekends.
I don't live too far from the international airport. If you do want to come in, Michael, and just nip in for a weekend or so. It's only a 27 or 28 hour flight from here to there. Anyhow, the part of that was the documentation of the steps that it takes, so that people understood why it takes so long for their model to get done, and the expense of it. But also at Kansas Fest, I was talking with Jason Scott, who was encouraging me to take the next step forward and find a larger audience and mass produce these things and get the pieces out there, so that people that didn't even know about 3D printing and didn't know about Raspberry Pi, or maybe even weren't necessarily a retro computer enthusiasts, had access to it or had a reason to get out there and get excited about it. And so as a result of that conversation, as with every conversation I come away from Jason, is I feel like I have to do something now. sometimes it's I have to go and run on a treadmill and get all this caffeine out of my system. But with that one, it was I have to start from point A and get all the way to point Z and document everything in between so that people can see it. And also, as a result, if someone doesn't know what to do as far as the 3D modeling, they can take my file and print it on their own printer and go from there. Or if they don't necessarily have access to a printer, they can order an already made part that's unpainted or unassembled from somewhere like Shapeways or iMaterialize or what have you, and then take it from there and paint it to match their own yellowed Apple II.
Well, that's right. They've got to make that decision. Do I do I finish it to match a new machine, or can I figure out what shade of beige that platinum has turned?
Yeah, yeah. Well, at each point during the steps, they could take off and make it their own. So, I can recreate my own desk from the 80s. Or someone that's a better model builder or painter than me could take an unfinished one and make one that is photorealistic for, you know, doing a miniature shoot with, for special effects or something. And it's all documented and it's all available along the way from the raw file and all the way up to a completely finished part. So if somebody wants to take their experience and build on, whatever I've provided, they can go from there.
I have to admit that when I saw the model of the Apple III, I loved it, but the first thing I thought was okay. Now we need a monitor III. If you don't want to make the monitor III, this video series will, or the write up will give you the opportunity to say we leave the monitor III as an exercise for the reader.
The homework item that the class can take away. Okay. Well, thanks, Charles, for giving us that overview of 3D printing. I'm sure there's plenty of exercises our listeners can take away, and we can all become experts. Or we can just drop into your store and buy the parts we're looking for.
Anytime.
Okay, well, we've got some listener feedback here. So, Paul, who have we got in some listener feedback today?
Well, in fact, actually, so I went through this relatively quickly, and both of these were sent to us by Tony, but so I'll just mention kind of quickly. He sent a couple of links, sort of interesting things. One of them is an Easter egg on an oscilloscope. Essentially, the Easter egg is that if you hold down certain buttons in a certain way, you can play Tetris on it. So there's a little link that shows photos of this happening. I think it's kind of cool. It doesn't look like a particularly old oscilloscope.
I was going to say, how old is this oscilloscope that they can program Tetris into it?
But anyway, you can follow that link. And the other link is, so it is a TI-82 series calculator that has been hooked up to some sort of audio mixer and is being used as a sequencer or a tracker. So I don't think these things had, actual audio output. I think it's being, it says it outputs 1-bit sound through the calculator link port. So I think probably there's some sort of translation being done. This is probably something that is designed to let calculators communicate to each other, but this, or maybe a printer or something like that, but it's being sort of co-opted to make 1-bit sound. But it actually sounds quite impressive in this video, so it's kind of neat to look at. And again, I'm not quite sure how old these are.
We should get Michael Mann on that.
Have like a table full of, TI-80X calculators playing a symphony.
Putting them into an Apple Crate-like organization, building a TI tower and throwing it out to a whole bunch of speakers.
That's a scary thought.
It seems possible. But anyway, those are both interesting links, and they're so I don't know my TI calculators. That sounds like it's relatively retro, right? TI 80 something.
I think that's from the 90s. That sounds about right. It sounds like the model that I used when I was in high school for calculus and calculus and AP chemistry. I think we used TI 81s.
Well, maybe we're old enough. Maybe that's retro.
That sounds all too modern for my high school. I think we were still using log tables.
We did have a teacher that tried to teach us how to use slide rules, but no one was having that.
I kind of wanted to know how to use those, but I never did learn, and except that I do have this idea that they're actually kind of cool. So I just haven't quite gotten to learn it, but I anticipate it being cool.
Yeah, obviously we're talking about slide rules, not logarithmic tables.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing cool about using log tables.
No.
But as an aside, I've actually got a slide rule on order that I've waiting for it to arrive. So I'll see how cool it is.
Maybe someday you can upgrade to an abacus.
I thought the slide rule was the upgrade from the abacus.
How many parallel calculations can you make on a slide rule at a time? I've seen people do some fascinating stuff with an abacus. Even just going from one-handed operation to two-handed operation, you've got full duplex there.
Oh.
Scary. Anyway, that's all the feedback I mined from our email at this point. But there's more that got left behind, and we'll try to get back to it.
Okay, so we have some interesting bits and pieces out there in Retro World. The first one, which I like to bring up, is that Tezza has a blog entry on servicing an Amstrad FD1 3-inch external floppy drive. We'll include the link in our show notes. But it's one of these situations that many retro collectors find themselves in. Someone's donated the drive. He didn't have anything to connect to it at the time, but definitely didn't want to let it escape. And the time has now come for the drive to be connected up, a little bit of servicing, some great shots, as always, from Tezza on his blog. So we have some detailed shots of the drive, what's wrong, the parts that he's got in, some drive belts, and a very well laid out story of getting the drive up and running, and then he has it shown connected to his Amstrad CPC 464. So lots of nice little bits of retro color in that machine, one of my favorite retro machines. So if you're feeling like what needs to be done to get a floppy drive operational, pop over to Terry's blog and have a look. So guys, have you had an opportunity to see Terry's work in action?
I've definitely seen other, you know, like some of his other things. I hadn't seen this. I think this, he just did this quite recently, right? This particular one.
Yes, but he always manages to get such good, clear shots. My photography skills are nowhere near as good as this. Then again, I don't know how many blurry shots he's had to throw away to get this blog entry going. But I think I'd be still taking the photos.
Yeah, Tezza has some very detailed breakdown and rebuilding posts as well. And does he have a series of videos as well on YouTube?
Oh yes, his videos are excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I haven't seen this one yet, but Tezza is definitely one of the names that pops up when I do a search for something, and he's the level of detail, like you said, is fantastic.
I saw this and wondered, and then confirmed when I was reading through the text that this is a 3-inch drive. It's not quite 3.5 inches. It's a kind of weird.
Yeah, when I first saw the shot, I was sort of going, "Oh, the aspect ratio doesn't quite look right." And then I realized that yes, the Amstrad drive is a 3-inch drive, and that the floppies are a little bit more rectangular than what you're used to. But
so the floppies themselves aren't square?
Well, they must be.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it's presumably it's a circle inside, right?
I would assume
it's just got a little bit more length on it, as far as the shape goes. But no, it's just another one of those formats that didn't quite cut the mustard.
The drive fell by the wayside. The sort of like, you know, attached external drive is comically long. I mean, you know, it's as long as probably like three of the floppies. Stacked, like, I don't know what's going on in the entire back half, like two thirds of this machine, but at any rate, it's a like a long skinny thing with just like a disk drive at the very end.
Yeah, I just like the fact that he's had some new 3-inch media that was just waiting to be used.
Very cool.
Well, if you've got a 3-inch drive, it would help to have the right floppy disks.
Well, and the replacement drive belts as well.
Yes, I like his forward thinking. So like, oh, if I'm going to have to order one piece in, I might as well order a few extra bits to save on the postage. But drive belts, I remember having to replace those in cassette players. That's something which I'm glad I don't have to do anymore. Okay, Paul, what's Steve Jobs up to?
Well, not a whole lot, actually. But There is a video here, so I'm not actually sure exactly what prompted this. I think in the description of the video on YouTube, it suggests that it's basically the imminence of the Steve Jobs movie, the Sorkin movie. But this is the Idea Machine Studio has posted a, basically it's sort of like an animation overlay over Steve Jobs introducing the Think Different marketing campaign. So this is probably a keynote at one of these Macworld or whatever it would have been at the time. So it's the audio of Steve Jobs, but it's also sort of animated in various different styles on top of it. It's interesting to look at. So anyway, that's about all there's to say about that. Although it's worth watching. So did anyone see this?
Yes, I started watching that last night, but had a distraction, so I haven't actually seen it through to the end. But
I guess my sense about this is that a lot of time went into that. I mean, a lot of time went into that. So it's interesting just to see, regardless of what's going on in the background in audio, it's interesting to see the work that went into it.
Having done a little bit of animation in my previous career, just with Flash and animated GIFs for advertising and that sort of stuff, anything that's animated that takes more than a few seconds, you just have to imagine the amount of time that goes into it is staggering to get it to look good. So if you see something that's animated that you like, you know that someone spent a considerable part of their lifetime making it.
So they've been working on this since the Steve Jobs movie was announced.
maybe since 97. I don't know. It's
right.
The tools are a lot better now, but the idea is still it's 24 or 30 frames per second, and each frame has to be rendered or keyframed or at least managed in some way. So, yeah.
Okay, so Charles, something very interesting about a Z1.
Well, in deference to everyone outside of the U.S., I'm going to call it the Z1. If you don't know the name Konrad Zuse, you might recognize Zuse as a character name from the last Tron movie, I think, as a direct reference to him. But he kind of gets credit for creating the concept of binary as a way for computers to keep track of things and to use as a means of storage rather than trying to use decimal numbers 0 through 9. And he did his work around the time of World War II, so he was also having to dodge bullets and tank shells at the time. But there's a great paper on... I'm gonna pronounce it archive.org, but it's arxiv.org, and it's called The Z1 Architecture and Algorithms of Konrad Zuse's First Computer. And if you go into the history of Zuse and his computers, they were mechanical computers using binary, again, probably for one of the first times that binary was used as a way of storing and doing calculations, using things like almost like phone relays, mechanical relays. And if you look at this paper, which will be linked in the show notes, I'm sure, you can see all the way down to the between the theoretical architecture of the Z1, which was his first fully realized computer, all the way down to the detail of the actual gates, the logic gates that he was using. And there are things like it's layers of sheet metal with holes punched in them with rods going through them so that when this plate gets pushed, it's a 1, and then it rotates the next plate to a 0. And it's just, it's fascinating mechanically, but also the idea that this was all being done before there were transistors and before there was even really vacuum tubes and things like that. And he was doing all these logical and mathematical functions with mechanical pieces, almost in the same way as you would think of the analytical engine or the Babbage machines hundreds of years before. They were, he was thinking of these things with gears and teeth and moving, rotating wheels. And then fast forward to the 1930s and 1940s, and the same sorts of things are being done, this time with mechanical parts made from metal and industrial level of accuracy and scale, and still working in a mechanical sense on making physical things move numbers and do logic. It's fascinating stuff. And like I said, this paper goes into a whole lot of detail, and it's available in a PDF you can download. It also links out to a variety of YouTube videos and photo streams of an installation of a reconstructed Z1 in Berlin. And you can walk around it in 3D and VR, and it's really fascinating stuff.
I would love to see this operate. Maybe I would want to stand behind a shield, but
or wear ear covers. Yeah,
it's definitely amazing. I just love this sort of mechanical computing, and have always sort of thought, what would have happened if this had been the way that things progressed? Would I have been a programmer or electromechanical engineer, or how things could have been different? But it's definitely a very impressive paper, and the photos, as you said, the videos, everything there, it's just phenomenal.
And I should say I'm saying Z1 for the sake of our audience, but it's all, if it was Zusa in Germany, it would be the Z1.
Okay, perfect.
Well, I've got an article here by one of our favorite hackers, and that's Ben Heck. He has revisited the ZX Spectrum project that he did in 2014, which is not really that long ago. I think it was about August, September 2014. But he's revisiting the ZX Spectrum, and this time he's including his schematic design PCB build to make a new portable Spectrum with an LCD screen. So part one was available September 25th, and part two has only just been released. There was a week in between where I think he was playing with a Roomba or something else. But October 9th, he's released part two. So watching these two, you'll be able to see his design process of going through and laying out the pieces that are required, the hooking it up, and then making, as this time he said, a more Spectrum-like case for it to go into. Last time he built it, it was a very large, I thought it was like an oversized, over-thick iPod, almost the way that it was constructed, but this one seems to be more to the Spectrum. It still doesn't have the same shape or presentation, but it's a wonderful project, and if you haven't seen any of Ben Heck's retro recreation work, this is a good one to go in and have a look. Two episodes, as I said, it's from design through to making it. And I suppose it does help that you've got a workshop that like his with all his toys, but there's most of it should be manageable in some way or form in your workshop at home. So pop over and have a look and see if you can make your ZX Spectrum.
Cool.
Yeah, I love Ben Heck's videos. Even though I would never have the workshop space or the money to afford the tools that he has, the design process that he documents he does a great job documenting all the way from starting with a CAD drawing or a sketch on paper or graph paper. And he shows you what the circuit diagrams are and how the theory of the circuits that he's building, all the way down to actually wiring it up on a PCB. It's great stuff.
Okay, Paul, do you want to fill us in on the Mockingboard?
Sure. Okay, so this is not super new, but it's something that we that I didn't mention before that Blake sent us. He put up a interesting article about the Mockingboard. Sweet Microsystems Mockingboard music generation, and I think there was actually a version that did some speech generation as well. System. So this is one of the main sound cards that was available on the Apple II platform. And so he kind of walks through like some of the details of the board and, you know, some of the software that supported it. There wasn't actually all that much that supported it. kind of leading into a discussion of the French Touch, who made a new kind of demo disc that plays chip tunes, basically. It does, it's, what is it called? Yeah, not so cheap tunes. I guess they're the French Touch, I suppose that makes sense. But at any rate, they it's kind of like a little tracker that plays media.
Are they MIDI files or MIDs, like mods or something?
I don't know for sure. But the end of the article is interesting, so you can take a look at that.
Every 10 seconds of every hour of every business day, America puts a brand new Epson computer or printer to work. Imagine that. Businesses of every kind and size putting the power of Epson into millions of hands. Every 10 seconds, another new Epson. It's true. When you've got an Epson, you've got a lot of company.
The Amstrad 464 is the 64K home computer with a monitor and data recorder included. From around $429, only our competitors aren't having fun.
Okay, and we're back from the sponsor message, and while we were away, Michael had to go. So I'm taking over the host's retro computing gift idea segment, and what I'm going to suggest, just because Charles is here, but probably I would have done this anyway, is the Disk 2 styled USB SD card reader from Retro Connector, which is, in fact, made by Charles here. We'll have the link to it, and what it is it's an SD card reader that looks like a miniature little Disk 2. So even if you don't want to clutter your office like I have with just actual huge machines, that you can plug this into your laptop and bring it around with you and amaze your friends. So normally I would ask the other people, you know, what they thought of this, but of course I'm sure you love it.
Yes, I'm very enamored of the Disk 2 and the miniature floppy drive that I make by hand, sweat of my brow. And if there are people out there, and I don't know why, but that don't necessarily like stuff with Apple logos on them, I can also make you an Atari one.
Oh yeah.
And I'm trying to find the model number for the Atari floppy that I make as well. I'm just not seeing it right now.
Well, there are a few. There's like 810, I think, is the big one, and the like 1030, something like that, is the littler, like newer styled one.
Oh, here it is. Atari 1050.
1050. Okay.
Yeah.
I just got one of those, like a real one, not long ago. Came with it was shipped, you know, it came actually just fine, and it has actually a nice little, like, cover, like, cozy for it. But the Atari 800 that it came with smashed all the bits. But, oh well. Anyway, they're pretty cool looking.
So yes, you can get that SD card reader in the Atari flavor, Atari 1050, or the Apple Disk 2.
Excellent. So, if you know some retro computing enthusiast who hasn't yet quite made the jump over to listening to this podcast, this is a gift you can get them. Okay, and so now we will continue spending money with eBay auctions, and so. Since I'm running the show here, I will say Michael has left us with his eBay auction, so we will have him do that here.
Okay, so now let's have a look at what's happening out on the wonderful world of eBay. So, having looked at Ben Heck's ZX Spectrum project, I thought it would be interesting to see what ZX Spectrums were actually available on eBay. And as you are wont to do, instead of finding some, well, there were some very interesting Spectrums available, but there are some excellent clones from Eastern Europe and from Russia. So the first one that I've got is a ZX Spectrum Mega from the Soviet Union. A lovely boxy shape. Looks totally not like a ZX Spectrum, but it has been tastefully placed in a lovely blue rectangular prism box, has a wonderful blocky power supply beside it. Very reminiscent of the Soviet era electronic design meme.
That's
But if you're after something solid and potentially life threatening, if you throw it at somebody, this could be the ZX Spectrum for you.
Yeah, I can really see the Soviet design in that.
It looks like it belongs on a submarine, you know, bolted to a mechanical panel. It's just that's stunning how that looks.
It is. And for something completely different, this time I've got a Delta SA Soviet clone of the ZX Spectrum, but this time it's doesn't look anything like the Spectrum itself, but this is a more tasteful red, looks like a plastic case, a little bit more contouring on it, and a slightly more complicated keyboard. And what I like in the comments of this one is that it says that it's been Russianized from the original ZX Spectrum, and the Russification effect compatibility with the programs, about 30% of the programs on it do not work as indicated in the manual. And I think that went through a translator into English as well. But yeah, some great shots there of another Spectrum clone. A little bit pricey, actually $45 shipping to me, not too bad, with a buy it now. Really, if you're after a ZX Spectrum with a little bit of difference, that's not an unreasonable buy it now price of $110, or make an offer. So if you're after something a little bit different in your collection, maybe one or both of these would look great.
Excellent. And with the Spectrum, you almost want to have a clone that's in each color. If you can get the blue one and the red one, and you get one for each of the rainbow colors.
Well, there's two of them. There's your red one and your blue one. Just a few more to fill in the gaps.
And then, and now we will resume with the rest of our eBay auction. So, yeah, Charles, maybe you can do yours first. Yours appears to be not so much an auction as a vendor.
Right, it's a seller that I follow on eBay, and I check their listings probably about once a week or every couple of weeks, depending on if I'm looking for anything specific or if I'm trying to make a sort of a dream purchase. Sometimes things they have return. But the seller is Austin Goodwill Computer Works, and it's all one word and all runs into itself. But the auctions that they have come from the Austin Goodwill Computer Works, and they had a museum for a while. I think the museum itself is closed, but they still have auctions on here of classic machines and new stuff as well. I think it's all coming from either the Austin Goodwill or the Austin area, things that people have donated or dropped off or surplus or what have you. So if I look on it right now, looking at their newly listed stuff, it's some pretty mundane kind of stuff. There's some speakers, there's some Nintendo controllers, a headset. But if you pay attention, you scroll down a little bit, or if you watch this seller from time to time, they'll have things on there. Like today, there's scrolling, a Commodore 64.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Pretty nice. Looks like it's in good condition. There's some IBM Model M computers.
Keyboards, you mean?
The Model M keyboard.
Right.
I didn't mean to offend. But then there's a Telstar Gemini, some great classic calculators, an Intellivision, Magnavox Odyssey 3000. And when I was growing up, we had the Odyssey 2.
Mm-hmm.
It's always shocked me that there were other Odysseys out there. We only, we had the Odyssey 2, and that was the one that I knew. And my friends had an Atari, and then down the road, a friend of ours had the Intellivision. There's things on here that I've never heard of and never seen, and there's things that I've always wanted. And they come up from time to time, Just sort of at random. I don't know that there's any rhyme or reason. It's just whatever gets donated or whatever gets put into the auction bin that day. And every auction starts at $9.99. And they're all set up for bids. They're not buy it nows. So some of the prices can go pretty high, but most of the time when I have successfully bought things from them or when I've tracked something in particular, they go for pretty cheap. So if you're looking to get something like a complete Intellivision system or some an old mouse to match your old keyboard or vice versa, keep an eye on the Austin Goodwill Computer Works eBay auction page. They have a lot of really good stuff, and it's always cycling through new things because it gets to the top of the list, and then they add more at the bottom.
I haven't been explicitly following them, but I definitely, whenever I see something of theirs pop up, I do go check to see what else there is. And I think it probably is a kind of a leftover aspect of this computer museum closing, but quite often they do have some, or at least they have in the past had some really quite amazing stuff go through there.
Well, and I think it's also part of Goodwill where people drop off everything and anything. They have a policy of they'll take whatever you drop off, and if they don't sell it in the store, in this case it goes on eBay, it looks like. Some of the stores where I am, they've stopped taking electronics altogether because they can't sell it or they don't know what to do with it, or it ends up going into e-waste and they don't want to be responsible for the recycling fees. But it looks like eBay is the way to go for Austin. So good on them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. And I had, Carrington, before we knew that he wasn't going to be able to be here, Carrington is Canadian and celebrating Thanksgiving. So happy Thanksgiving to Carrington and the Canadians. He'd linked a TechStep, which I have co-opted. There's a TechStep dealer diagnostic tool on eBay. And, it's a fairly complete one here, and it's expensive. It's selling for like $5.95 buy it now at the moment. And so, these things, they're semi-rare. To find them in this kind of complete shape is pretty unusual. So, this has a bunch of manuals. It has the case. It has the cables and the power supply.
Does it have all the necessary ROMs for testing the various?
It has four of them, it looks like. Hard drive tests one, which I think comes with all of them. CPU tests volume 2, 3, and 1. It's not all of them, but it is... it's a useful variety.
And for folks that don't know what the TechStep is, it would be for a dealer or for someone that is a repair technician, essentially, to diagnose hardware problems in the early Macs. Is that right?
Yeah. So from the way they work, I think, is you sort of plug them into the computer and they signal to it at some quite low level, go into diagnostic mode and give me your data. So it can test voltages. It can test, whether the hard drive is okay. That's the SCSI hard drive test one. And then each of these CPU tests ROMs has a certain range of machines it covers, volume one has the classic, the SE30, 2X, 2CX. Volume 3 is the 2CI, 2SI, 2VI, 2VX.
Depending on which of the 68,000 processors and coprocessor families it has in it,
right,
it'll send the right test suite for that machine.
And so there is a link here somewhere to one of the main places I've come across on the net that has information about the TechStep, which is on forcedperfect.net. And here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 ROM packs, 6 known ROM packs are listed. So 4 out of the 6 is not bad. But that's always the trick with these things is, you get it, but they're only useful for the machines that the ROMs are good for.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have 2 of these, and in honor of this auction coming up, I took them both out because I wanted to see how they worked. They were sold to me as non-working, and that was accurate. So they take a little 9-volt battery in the back, and I don't have the adapter, but I managed to, you know, find a 9-volt battery and plug them in. So I have two, and they both show the same symptom. I flip it on, and the little power LED goes blip, and then that's it. And I tried swapping the main board inside, various things, and nothing changes anything. So I think at some point, unfortunately, I don't have any sort of diagnoser for these diagnosers.
I was going to say, could you get a working one and use it to diagnose the broken ones?
Right, a tech step or something. But anyway, so yeah, if anybody knows how to, if that symptom tells somebody, oh yes, there's just, simple fix X. But I opened it up and I looked at the internals, and everything looked clean. It didn't look like there were any capacitors that could have leaked in there. So don't know. Anyway, someday I'll maybe figure it out, or, quite possibly it was plugged into a power adapter with the wrong polarity. They both came from the same seller. It's quite possible that he did this to both of them. But this one, apparently, the listed one, does seem to be tested, I think. So if you have $600 on you and want just to get it over with and have the whole set without trying to collect the pieces, this is one way to do it. So there was another sort of similar thing that I had seen, which is I haven't looked too carefully at this, but this seems to be basically like a voltage tester kind of thing. It's a new construction. Apple Macintosh Compact Mac Voltage Diagnostic Tool. So it appears to be just a little thing, with little LED display, numeric, whatever, however many. How many things are these 8-segment displays? That you plug into a port on the Mac and just, it tells you what the voltages are. So,
Oh, yes.
It looks, whatever, seems kind of, oh, I see who this is. Actually, he says in the listing, mm-hmm. Charles Phillips, maccaps.com. This is somebody who frequents the Macintosh Facebook group and does recapping and things like that. So I'm sure this is useful for that purpose. And it's kind of neat that he's making these available for other people as well. So
yeah, I'd love to see if it has a schematic or a breakdown of how you could make your own or get a kit from him, because it looks like it'd be a nice thing to put together with some basic skills, mm-hmm. and then you have something you can diagnose your own. It looks like it just measures a few of the outputs on the floppy disk port on the back.
Yeah.
There's one of the ports that it just plugs into, and then it gives you a readout of plus and minus 12 and then the 5 volts. And so if you see that those are one or the other of them is out of whack, it would indicate to him which set of capacitors are leaking. To me, it would just say this one's bad, this one's good. I don't know from there the diagnostic step, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
you can plug it in and say, okay, it's the plus 12, so I need to go in this range and then find the caps that are there. That's cool.
Yeah, it does look like a pretty basic device. Oh, actually, it also looks. I was wondering about the plug, because I believe this is, so it's plugging into the floppy port, and I believe this is the same connector that the big mess of wires has made a run on, and taken the world stock so that it can make the floppy emus.
That 19-pin.
Yeah,
the DSEV 19-pin. Yeah,
but it does appear that these are basically just pins on a line at the end here. It looks like. So if you don't want to build one, this one is built. It does look like it would be actually a relatively low bar project to try on your own as well. The last thing I was just going to mention was, initially what I was going to say was there's a Applied Engineering D-Clock module for the Apple IIc clone that Plamen Vaisalov, I guess, I don't know how you pronounce it. It's the Plamen that we always talk about, who makes sort of Apple II things. These are generally clones of other things. And so the clock module for the Apple IIc is just kind of recently available. But actually, all the things that he makes are interesting. And so I instead linking to his store. So he's got a disk 2 emulator, the SD floppy 2, the clock module, senior prom, which is a kind of like an alternate alternate ROM, often used for sort of like breaking in or you know cracking software, that sort of thing. A prototype board and a floppy disk adapter. So interesting stuff.
Yeah, the disk 2 emulator is great. I've got two or three of those. For one is actually installed inside of a 2C because it basically just plugs right into the disk 2 port. Yeah, and the other ones I use for booting up my 2E and for doing disk image swapping and stuff. So that little guy is great. It's just it's a disk 2. You put in an SD card and it you can see 16 folders numbered 0 through F, and you've got a disk image on each folder, and you can basically click through which one you want to boot from or which one you want to read from. And it's a really nice nice package, and he's great about doing support for it as well. Even though he is in Bulgaria, it ships really quick. So definitely recommend that. And then he does have some other clone type things and some kits that he sells from time to time, and he just puts them on eBay when they're done. And when they're sold out, they disappear, and you just have to wait for him to put another one back up.
From what I understand, he is actually planning on opening a web storefront soon, but I think that's not quite there yet. And you actually have am I wrong about this? Do you have a case for the SD floppy 2?
I do, yes. The one that he sells has a really nice metal case around it, and it's a really nice design. But I took it upon myself to make a case that goes around the innards. You have to take his case off of it and put the PCB into the case that I make so that it looks more like a disk 2. So it has the little door that opens up, and the vents in the back, and all the rest. So, the guts come out, and then they go into the case that I can that I sell on my Etsy store.
But yeah, it is a. I mean, the device is great, and actually, another connection that I think I probably mentioned here before, but definitely on Drop 3 Inches is that this is the device that you sent me the cable for, you know, that I was able to boot an Apple III off of as well. So not just for the Apple II.
Right. Anything that'll read a disk II. Mm-hmm. So basically an Apple II or an Apple III.
Yep.
So, or if you want to plug it into an Apple IIe card in a Color Classic, for instance.
Right. Anyway, okay, so I guess that basically closes out the eBay auctions, and this is winding up being a fairly long episode. That basically brings us to the end, so we can do sort of closing discussions. And Michael did not leave us with... Oh, he did. Yeah. So so I will now cut back in time to Michael. Michael, what are you doing?
Nothing much has been happening in my end of the world in retro computing. My auxiliary graphics adapter hasn't progressed beyond the working proof of concept that I talked about in the last episode. So really I should get in and do a little bit more programming on that so I can actually shoot the video of it in action. Being one of those projects that won't work in an emulator because it's doing something that the emulators were never programmed to do. So hopefully I'll have some videos soon of my Apple IIc doing graphics to a DVI monitor going beyond the limits of its built-in high-resolution graphics. So stay tuned, and I'll let you know when I've got something there.
Okay, and... Charles, did you have anything you wanted to say in here? I have a couple of things I was going to say.
Oh, in the closing discussion. Basically, I've been working on the same stuff that I've been working on since Kansas Fest. A lot of things that I sort of pre-announced and hinted at in various online fora about the Apple III, for instance, the Lisa and Mac XL models that are available now. I just keep making more connections, and people online keep finding me and asking me to make replicas or replacements for various parts. And I'm actually doing something that's really fun with the guys. Actually, go ahead and cut this part out because I'm not supposed to talk about it, I don't think. Anyhow.
All right.
but yeah, I keep getting custom requests for pieces of old machines that are broken or are missing, and to make models of them. And so I'm working through my queue. If you have something, you can contact me. And yeah, so I just working through my to-do list.
Cool. Yeah. Excellent. It's amazing you have the time, but that's the thing I seem to lack the most. Let's see. So I've done a couple of things. In my kind of ongoing pursuit to declutter a little bit, and you know, all that tends to mean really is just kind of like reassemble and put in some sort of perpendicular form rather than actually getting rid of anything. But I probably for about a year and a half or 2 years, maybe even longer, I've had a Compact Portable 2 sitting like disassembled on a table, taking up the whole table. I've decided, all right, well, I need to like use this table for something else. And so I was going to put it away. And so, you know, I figured I'd at least finish the project. And it occurred to me that, so CF cards, they're basically just little IDE drives, basically. And I was looking at the guts of the Compact Portable 2 and realizing, all right, well, it's actually, this drive is an IDE drive. I think it's an MFM drive bridged to an, you know, like a ATA controller. And so just on a whim, basically, I had, I saw that I had just a really simple straight through adapter, you know, the IDE to CF adapter. I mean, really, there's nothing going on this. There's no LEDs, there's no jumpers, there's nothing. It's just, you know, it goes as master and there's nothing else happening. And I stuck that in the controller card inside the Compact Portable 2, and it worked pretty much just like out of the box. Like,
nice.
So I now have the, I've got it set up so it's, you know, it's booting DOS, you know, 330, I guess. And you know, there's no drives in sight, and the floppy drive, actually, I'm really having a heck of a time with that. It's the drive door is sticking in such a way that, I pinch myself practically every time trying to close it because it requires huge force to close it, and then it doesn't open again. You know, like I can open it from the outside, reaching in from the top, but if I ever put it back in the machine, so I haven't yet figured out what I'm going to do with that. But another kind
of just replace all the spinning media with solid state and
yeah,
get on with your life.
It's quite possible that's yeah, what I will need to do. But the thing about the drive here is that it has a like a flip door that's actually, you know, it looks nice in the thing. So maybe I just need to keep the flip door and have it flip open to like an SD card reader. Another thing that was quite interesting, I thought, was another one of these moments when I kind of like leapt on eBay after a couple of minutes of listing, but somebody had posted this 2 drive, not a very interesting looking picture or whatever, but in the series of pictures, as you kind of went and looked through it, the serial number on it was 145. I mean, like 00145. And so I bought it. I now have it. I got this knowing full well that basically what I was buying was the label. and as it turns out, the there's more inside than I thought there would be, but the analog board is not there. So the rest of the stuff is there, though. And it's got kind of a weird Shugart serial number on it. It's the serial number appears to be basically just like the date, you know. So I'm hoping kind of that what I have, I mean, the thing is, I'll never really know the story behind this, so I can just imagine. There's another part to the story too. Maybe I'll say that as well. That from the same seller at the same kind of time, I got this weird two disk, you know, so it's got two disk twos inside an enclosure. You know, so it's, they've been taken out of their case, but they're in this enclosure that says Xerox, you know, AB. And at that time, Shugart is was a subsidiary of Xerox, and inside the, and you know, so I don't know what the serial numbers of the drives would have been, because they don't have their normal cases anymore. They're inside this other thing. But the analog boards on those are super old. I mean, like, you know, they're from the first kind of run. So I think, you know, I think all of these things came from the same place. And I'm kind of hoping that these are, you know, this was sort of like Shugart playing around with ideas of how to package two drives in one and that sort of thing.
Or some engineers sort of homemade attempt at a duo disc before it was available. He sat down.
Exactly.
Screw it. Why can't I just shoehorn both of these in, give them the same power supply and daisy chain them? That's pretty cool. Do you have those photos available somewhere?
I took a couple, you know, I posted a couple on Twitter of like the weird thing. I'll probably take, you know, like more sophisticated photos and put a blog post up about them or something like that. But it's pretty cool. And, you know, just the idea of having, you know, I know that this two, you know, serial number one was at the Apple pop-up museum and so forth, but still, so many of these things were produced that you know, to have something that's labeled as being the 145th one is really just quite stunning. So, because I mean, these things number in the, you know, the hundreds of thousands.
Right.
Wow. So, anyway, very pleasing. And, you know, that was just a very quick notice and lucky moment, and then buy it now. So it wasn't actually even all that expensive. So, but anyway, so these are the things that were occupying my time. You know, I got a cool thing. I got the Compact Portable 2 to boot. And I've been doing some other stuff, but that's enough for this moment. But okay, so I guess that's basically it for this show. So you can find all the show notes for... Oh, and I should say, thank you, Charles Mangan, for joining us today.
Anytime. Anytime you need another spoke on the wheel or another seat at the table to make it more round, I'll be glad to join.
Yeah, great. Good to have you. And very interesting all around. So, but yes, so that's about it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, and you can send us feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, and if you have a chance, please write a review on iTunes. It will help other people find the show. And so, with that, I guess... Until next time, retro compute. Perfect. Perfect dish.